This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Our guest today is Chris Matthews, host of the television show Hardball on MSNBC, where his feisty and assertive style of questioning has become his trademark. His loud laugh and rapid-fire delivery are familiar to his viewers and have been satirized on Saturday Night Live. Before journalism, Matthews worked a number of political jobs, including as a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter and as an assistant to the late Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. At one point, he even packed a 38 as a member of the U.S. Capitol Police Force. Matthews' new book is called Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. And he joins me here in Studio 3A. And Chris Matthews, great to have you on Talk.
Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be at this
privileged
spot.
Well, we should feel privileged.
It's very feng shui in here, by the way. It's very wide open. I love it.
I'm glad. Do you like the earth tones?
I like the wood on the floor. Natural wood.
All right.
I love it.
As always, we want to hear from you. If you have questions for Chris Matthews about his life as a journalist, a talk show host, a member of the Peace Corps in Africa, or working in the White House, our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-98-TALK. 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email at talk@npr.org and join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Now, Chris Matthews, first of all, congratulations. 10 years of Hardball.
That's
right. Accomplishment.
Amazing.
Now, you write in your book that you were hooked on politics from an early age. What grabbed you? What hooked
you? I can't tell you, except that I knew being on the school bus as a first grader, knowing that Eisenhower was running, and being in a Republican family, being for Eisenhower, and a lot of the other kids around me, of course, it was Catholic school, and a lot of them were Democrats. But funny thing is, I think a lot of Democrats voted for Eisenhower in 52. And it was fun. And then, of course, by the 60 campaign, the Kennedy-Nixon race, which I wrote a book about, was just compelling politics. Two heavyweights, young guys going at each other, relatively matched. And dynamite. It was the days when people still wore campaign buttons and people wore skimmer hats. And there was an excitement. There were big crowds. Nixon drew 500,000 people in Philadelphia on Wednesday afternoon. Hmm. Kennedy would draw crowds like that. It was the time when people really came out to rally and meet the politicians. Even though we had television, there was something tangible and palpable in the excitement.
Hmm. And was politics something that sort of happened around the dinner table in your family? I mean, did you guys all sort of yell at each other about this growing up?
Different levels. My dad was the sort of guy who would ask questions of a tough father who would say, "Where'd you hear that? Who told you that?" Always suspicious of the teachers. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a Democratic committeeman in Philadelphia, classic ward healer, a guy who basically relied on the Democratic organization for jobs. Who took great pride in being an Irish Catholic Democrat, Charles Patrick Shields. So I had that behind me. But I think it was really I just was fascinated. No one else in my family's like me. I was just into it.
I want to talk more about your early years in politics and some of your early work, but I want to play something from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
You make me laugh already, Anthony.
I think we all laughed.
It was a moment, wasn't it?
Well, for our listeners who don't know, you made an appearance on The Jon Stewart Show on your book tour talking about Life's a Campaign. And Stewart, I don't want to say roughed you up, but he didn't really let you answer the question. So let's just listen for a moment to this.
But politicians often listen, but they don't. It's a contrivance.
It's not a contrivance. I'm listening to you.
Sometimes when you read the book, it seems like what you're saying is do what you think will win, not do what you think is right.
Well, it's both.
This seems to emphasize the former.
It does. It's about... Can you come on Hardball?
What?
Yes, come on Hardball. We can play this game both ways.
I don't troll.
You are unbelievable. This is a book interview from hell.
No,
this is the worst interview I've ever had in my life.
It was something, wasn't it?
That was very funny, though. But I want to give you a chance to answer the question that basically he was asking about your book. This idea, Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, Success. His point was, politics are awful. Politicians are awful. It's about deceit. It's about contrivance.
That's not true.
Well, go ahead. Answer the question.
Really good political leaders, and there are good ones, are fantastically curious about the people that they lead and the people they want to represent. And people like Bill Clinton is an astounding listener of people and student of people. If you're ever with him, you see it. George Bush Sr. was like that. They remember things about you. You forget. They remember everything. You'll meet them months later, and someone like George Bush Sr. will remember your father's politics. He'll think about your politics. Have you talked to him lately? Has he changed your mind? I mean, I'm impressed. Hillary Clinton. I met her the other day. She was all over my daughter, talking about how my daughter's at Penn and how she's studying and how impressed she was with her and details about my daughter. I mean, how do these people master that much information about so many tens of thousands of people? Because they do have that innate interest in people, the best of them. Now, some of them don't have it. I don't think George Bush, the president, has it. I don't think Jimmy Carter has it. They're not really. I don't think Fred Thompson has it. But I think Hillary has it, and she's learning it. And I think her husband definitely has it. And I don't think Obama does, although I'm fascinated by his
potential. Let me stop you there.
I don't think they're all good at it. But what I try to do in this book, Life's a Campaign, was try to find the traits that I've discovered in the really good political life that are good for everybody to learn. If you want to get to know people, to have people trust you, to want to build friendships, there's a lot you can learn from these people. I mean, a lot about human nature.
This is Chris. We're talking with Chris Matthew, host of Hardball on MSNBC, and he's author of Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. You can join the conversation at 800-989-8255. You worked for the late, great Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts, former Speaker of the House. You call it the best and toughest political job you ever had. Was he one of these people that, you know, rates as one of the great politicians in Europe?
Certainly. He won 50 straight elections in Massachusetts. Starting in the 30s, he taught me so much. When he first met my Aunt Eleanor, who's still alive and has been teaching kids special education, retarded kids, we used to say, going back to 1943, and she's still around teaching in Philadelphia in the schools. And when he first met her, she had come down to lobby for liberal causes. She was a social activist, maybe not a Dorothy Day Catholic, but certainly out in the social front. And she's sitting in his office waiting for him. And here comes this 300-pound guy rolling in the room, big shot, and this nice little quiet woman from Philly. And he goes, "Dear, good to see you. So how long you been out of the habit?" The first thing he asked her was, what was it like the day you didn't have to wear that face-squeezing old Elizabethan costume and could become like a regular person? And she just lit up, and she told him all about it. And he knew how to connect with people by listening to them.
Yeah. And you write that he knew, he kept a sense of humor, he understood politics, he knew that half the country didn't like him, it didn't bother him.
That's right.
Except for the fact that I guess he was, he was reprimanded by some nuns who said, be nicer to Mr. Reagan.
That bothered him. But I did tell this story in the book about his relationship with Reagan when Reagan was close to death after the assassination attempt, and it was almost a sacrament. I mean, here he was observed sitting next to Reagan, actually kneeling on the floor on his knees next to Reagan's bedside. He had kissed Reagan, and they were holding hands, and they were reciting the 23rd Psalm together, "The Lord is my shepherd," together. And to me, that picture is everything good about American politics that separates us from so many other countries about our willingness at our best to face a common humanity. And here are two guys of philosophical different directions who didn't agree on much, but there was a love of common humanity that brought them together. He never told me that story. We found out from oral histories at the UVA, at University of Virginia, Max Friedersdorf, who was there and watched it. It's something else. I remember meeting Reagan the first time, and I said to Mr. Reagan, because we used it as the holding room for him when he gave States of the Union address, the Speaker's ceremonial office, and I had this big desk out in front of that, like a Mandarin, you know. I was right there at the door. And I went in to see him, and I said, "Mr. President, welcome to the room where we plot against you." And Reagan goes, "Oh, no, not after 6. The Speaker says we're all friends after 6. And I think democracy to work needs professionals, professional politicians. Now, nobody wants to hear this, the purists, but you can't have a constitution work unless there are professionals to be your leaders. And in the end, they have to be civil with each other. They have to be.
Well, I want to talk more about that because that seems like something we're getting away from these days. But let's let some callers in on this conversation. Let's go to Tim, who's calling from San Jose, California. Hi, Tim. You're on with Chris Matthews.
Well, thanks so much for taking my call, and greetings to Chris. I have used your book continually in my introduction to political science courses over many, many years now. So I must say that it's a great entree into politics and an understanding of politics as relationships and the principles behind it. So I appreciate your excellent writing. I think it really engaged my students.
Thank you.
And I am currently working, actually, now I'm walking the walk. I was a longtime advocate for National Community Service, and now I'm at the San Jose Conservation Corps. And one of your comments on National Community Service, it's something that I think we've toyed with politically. We've never been all that serious about it, except rhetorically, but we've never backed it with any serious funding or commitments. And just wanted your comments, given that you had a Peace Corps background.
All right, Tim. Yeah, we should mention you did do volunteer work for the Peace Corps.
Well, I did the Peace Corps for 2 years in Africa, and I got more out of it than anybody I taught over there. I had a 120 Suzuki, and I motorcycled around rural Swaziland, and I taught small business to small businessmen who were about, most of the guys were in their 50s. I was in my early 20s. I got to tell you, there's a book. That's a story that's just, to me, my life, and changed everything about my self-confidence and everything. I don't know. I don't like the idea of a real compensated national service or a mandatory national service. I think if it's mandatory, you'll get a lot of dregs in there and people that are just miserable and why do I have to do this? And I can't wait for it to be over, and probably some bad apples in the pack. But if I guess it's going to have to be more of a cultural thing. I think you're seeing it more in some of the schools. A lot of kids are coming out of college today at 21 and 22 doing national service, whatever the program is, whether it's secular or religious. They're doing it on their own. My son went over to Rwanda with the Clinton Global Initiative for 5 months. That's what I think people should do. I can advise it because it changes your life. I mean, you immediately go from being a kid to a positive rite of passage. You're not risking your life generally. And you're coming back with a knowledge of the world and a sense of self-confidence. And also you did something good. I mean, how can you beat that? I don't think you have to sell it. Just have people think about it a little, and they'll say, yeah, that's a good idea.
We're talking with Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball. His new book is called Life's a Campaign, and we'll get to more on that and more on your calls in a minute. You can give us a call at 800-989-8255. You can also send us email talk@npr.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. In the introduction to his new book, Chris Matthew writes, "Welcome to a noisy inside peek at people with power and the good you can learn from them." That book is called Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. You can read more from the book at our website, npr.org/talk. Chris Matthews, of course, is the host of Hardball on MSNBC, and he's with us here today in the studio. If you have questions for him, give us a call at 1-800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Chris Matthews, I want to talk to you a little bit about your trademark interview style. And before we do, let's just listen to a little bit from Hardball, just so we get a sense of
I'm sure
of what
it's
you
a
do.
Great sense of it.
Let's listen to this.
All right.
I've been thinking through this campaign and what's missing. And having watched so many campaigns and knowing about so many in history, I see one thing missing. Inspiration. I don't hear a candidate who's promising us deliverance from the track we're on, the track being an endless war in Iraq and probable war with Iran. I don't hear someone stepping out of that rut and saying, I'm going to deliver you to a different place. Someone who's not just going to impress us like Hillary does all the time, but inspire us. Do you see that? Do you see anyone out there running who's going to take this country of ours to a different place if they get elected?
And then he was going to answer that question, but we ran out of time. Right? No, your interviewing style, where does it come from? It's pushy, it's feisty.
Obviously, it's not always good manners. I'm trying to think, and I'm trying to talk, and I have this passion and a point of view. It's not partisan, my point of view. I think if you listen to me over 10 years now, and a little more than that in other programs, I don't have a partisan edge. I vote mostly Democrat, although I voted for Bush the first time. I voted for Michael Steele for the Senate. He's a Republican. I usually vote for Connie Morrell. I vote for Arlen Specter, but generally Democrat. But I'm not pushing a party, but I am pushing a point of view on things. And they're not always the usual.
But not a political point of view?
It's not a consistent. I'm very tough on illegal immigration, so that doesn't put me in the pack of most tolerant liberal journalists. Although I'm against, you know, I can take positions that I'm pro-choice, and I can take a position on pro-gay marriage now. I think I go through these interesting changes. I think I'm protean. I think I'm growing. After this embarrassment out there in Minnesota with that senator, I had the strangest reaction. First of all, it was like distaste. Like, why do these people get involved in these anonymous relationships? And I said, damn it, if we don't respect people, they're not going to respect themselves. I'm for gay marriage. Let's just be that way. Let's accept equality here. There isn't a separate but equal role here. And I did read back about the just recently about the Brown case. And you know why the judges on the Supreme Court decided it was wrong to have separate but equal? It had nothing to do with the law. It was a broad interpretation. It was activism. They said, based upon studies, it made people feel bad. They had the black kids looking at the doll, saying the white doll's better than the black doll. They decided that separate but equal made people, and they said, this republic shouldn't make people feel bad. And my feeling is about a lot of these social issues, I'm in a flux. I tend to be a Tory with liberal positions. I tend to be very culturally conservative. But on each issue, I say, darn it, that's right. That's got to be the right thing to do. I have to drag myself. So I don't fit this. I know enough liberals to know what a liberal is. A liberal is a person who's very innate with their sort of liberal values, and they buy the whole, what I call the blue plate special, the whole array. I'm not like that. So I don't think I fit a mold.
That clip we heard was from the show yesterday, and I want to ask you about that because you made a comment on that show yesterday. You said something, words to the effect that Barack Obama's problem was that he was too NPR, too far above the grid of politics.
That's exactly right.
Chris Matthews, what did you mean by that? What does NPR mean?
I think too NPR means quite this, that purist. That there's something wrong with rough and tumble politics, that there's something wrong with putting your elbow out and stopping the other guy.
But what is rough and tumble politics? Negative campaigning?
No, it means the following. Jack Kennedy, I talk about in the book, Jack Kennedy was able to take every shot at him from Richard Nixon and throw it back at him. He actually did a wonderful lampoon of this. A burlesque, he'd say to crowds, hundreds of thousands of people, would say, Richard Nixon accused me of being, he accused Harry Truman of being a traitor. He accused Lyndon of being an ignoramus. Lyndon says he accused me of being an ignoramus. No, he accused Lyndon of being an ignoramus. He listed all the attacks, idiot, barefaced liar, and he threw them right back at Nixon in a way that was so funny. Then even if I were Nixon, I'd have to laugh. It was so good. I think Barack Obama has to take on Bill Clinton, not Hillary. The smart move here, take on the big guy. Because if you take on her, he'll come to her defense. Say to Bill, you said the other day, I think it was 4 or 5 days ago, that you were more experienced than I was when you finally ran for president in 92, and you would have been wrong to run in 88. Well, let me tell you something. Your experience backed us in two wars in the Persian Gulf, and you're wrong. Those wars have not helped us out. Your experiences ran against us and hurt our country. I'll take my inexperience to your experience. I remember a Reagan line when everybody was saying he was irresponsible, and Reagan said, okay, I'll admit I'm irresponsible if you'll admit you're responsible. And I think you got to turn things around. I keep waiting for this guy to engage. To get out there and challenge Mrs. Clinton, to challenge the senator. And he's now down to 20 points. He is dropping. Hillary's up to over 50, an absolute majority on the international betting right now. She's a 1-2 shot against the field now. You can't make any money betting on Hillary anymore in the world. So I think he's got to engage. I don't say get negative, but he has to challenge. And you know what he has to do? Somebody said to me the other day, start referring to the Clintons as the incumbents. Just say, well, the incumbents.
But this idea of being too NPR, does that mean he's too high-minded? To be relevant.
Well,
to
the, a lot of people believe that the only way to win in the Iowa caucuses is to have nothing to do with politics. They go in there and give nice, spiritually uplifting speeches and say nothing about your opponent, nothing about the competition, and somehow people are going to notice you and elect you. Well, maybe they will. But this will be rare because I've supported high-minded candidates like Gene McCarthy and Tsongas and Gary Hart, and every one of them lost because they were so high-minded.
Let's take a call. Let's go to Marty, who's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Hi. Hi, Marty.
Actually, I just wanted to get Chris's opinion on politics today. While there is nothing wrong with good, healthy debate in the political arena, it just seems that today anything political arises, steps into a slut fest.
Where do you see that, sir?
Well, you know, whether it's campaigning or
but where do you see a slugfest right now?
Right now, oh, my goodness, whatever comes up in Congress or, you know, it seems the guys go at each other more personal than they do a good, healthy debate on an issue. And I was wondering, is it a trigger? Is it a line that was crossed? Or is it kind of where this has morphed into in today's politics?
Do you buy the premise, Chris, that there's a little too much slugfesting going on out there?
Well, there's not enough respect across the line. I don't think you have to disrespect your opponent to disagree with them. I do think you have to engage. I think the American people like a healthy debate. I mean, they really like it. And I do think it's missing. I think that there is a lost art of standing in front of an audience with, alongside someone else and debating your differences. I find these debates depressing. There are too many people in the room. I think that they, except for the real backbenchers and the hopeless causes who will throw a grenade now and then, the front runners are being incredibly careful. Senator Clinton went on 5 television shows last week and didn't make any news. It reminded me of growing up in the 50s and watching the boxers clinch. All they did is clinch, and we were bored to death with those kind of boxing matches. I do think debate's lively. I mean, Lincoln did it. Roosevelt did it. I mean, go back and look at the greatest political speech of all times was a lampoon. It was Franklin Roosevelt in his bad health in 1944 when he was in his late months of life. He took on Dewey by making fun of the way that the Republicans had gone after him for going back in the Aleutian Islands to get his dog Fowler. And he ended up making the Republicans look stupid. It was a brilliant repartee, and he was the king of it. And later on when I was growing up and I heard Tom Dewey making fun of Jack Kennedy in the 60 convention, my dad said to me, and I loved having my dad around because he would tell me these things, he'd say, oh, that's what Roosevelt did to him, you know. But it was funny, and it was uplifting. And at the end of the debate, you say, what a great show. Now let me think about who I like. And I don't think it was degrading. I thought that, as I said again, I worked for Speaker Tip O'Neill for 6 years, and I thought his fight against Reagan, although occasionally personal, was generally philosophical. And there was a lot of mutual respect to the point where both men looked better at the end of the debate. And that would be my standard. Chris, if the debate raises the level of both candidates, we all win.
Chris, let me ask you about your switch in your career. When you moved over to journalism, you worked in the Peace Corps. You worked for Tip O'Neill, as you mentioned. You were a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, among other political jobs. Have you ever looked back, you know, switching over to journalism? Have you ever looked back at those days? And the reason I ask this is it represents such different kind of work. And I'm just wondering if you've ever felt, differently about it or conflicted about that switch.
It's a happier life.
This one?
No, the other one, in a way. I mean, I remember when I worked for Tip O'Neill for 6 years, I worked for Jimmy Carter for 4 years before that, and Ed Muskie before that. You always know what side you're on. So even though you have questions as you look at your boss's positions, and you may not like some of them or de-emphasize them and emphasize others, you always know when you get up in the morning what side you're on. And it's easier mentally to prepare on that front. If you get up in the morning as a critic and you're looking at all the sides of various debates and trying to find weaknesses in their arguments or problems you have with them, it's dispiriting because after a while you begin to be like a Broadway critic, someone who's simply getting up and not putting on a show like a Broadway producer or actor, but you're getting up thinking where you can find problems with people. It's not as much fun. I know I had the independence now I didn't have working for politicians. So I would say plus and minus, there's a minus to being an independent critic because you don't have a side you can root for relentlessly and enjoy. I'm saying something that you don't hear much. Most people would say, oh, it's better to be independent. The problem with true independence is you don't have any loyalties, and therefore you don't feel good every morning you get up that you're advancing a cause.
But I'm just wondering if there's any sort of thinking on your part that there's so many of you guys now inside the Beltway doing this kind of thing. This sort of punditocracy gets bigger and bigger and bigger. There was a time when you were, you know, fighting the good fight. You were on the right-hand man of Tip O'Neill. Yeah. And, I mean, do you ever think about that?
Yeah, I do think. I don't think there are that many of us, but not many of us with shows that have been on for 10 years.
Well, that's true.
But there's 4 or 5 of us at least on our network and certainly 4 or 5 on Fox. And I do agree that our currency is not as valuable as being a senator. But, you know, I wasn't the Speaker of the House. I was his aide. I was chief of staff. I was AA to him. I had a nice title. I had a nice responsibility. People say, do you miss the Hill? And that's, I guess, your question. My answer is, if I were Speaker, I'd miss it.
Mm-hmm.
But it had to move. I had to move on.
Well, let's take a call. Let's go to Dana, who's calling from Washington, Washington, Missouri.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there, Dana.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Dana.
Hi. My husband and I are, of course, faithful watchers of your show.
Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you a couple of years ago, Thanksgiving vacation, my daughter was at the airport in Boston. She got so excited. This is in her early 20s, and she said, Chris Matthews is next to me. She called me, and I said, well, talk to him. And she did, and she said, well, I love you, Chris Matthews, and my father loves you, too. Well, I think the object is this is a girl in her young 20s. you are bringing politics to the younger people. You're making it exciting. You're going to the colleges. And I think you're exposing them to the excitement of politics.
Thank you. That's a great tribute. Thank you. And I love the college. Talk about loving what you do. There is nothing that like going into a campus and sitting up on the stage at the assembly hall and having a big-name politician like John McCain, for example, who used to do these very well. He was so good at this. And they'll come walking down the aisle. And Schwarzenegger did it one time. And they come walking down the aisle. The students go crazy. It's like a pep rally. And then for an hour, we ask the questions the student wants to ask and engage. You know what? We bring politics to them, and we let them set the pace. It's great stuff. It is like being Billy Graham in a secular world. I love it.
Thanks for the call, Dana. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Scott, who's calling from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I love the show. Chris, I was wondering if you can tell us your opinion of the rise of the liberal blogosphere.
Well, it's a little new to me. It's very critical. If you think I'm critical, it's much more critical than I am of everything that I do. I hope that it stays protean. It grows into a much more, various kind of points of view. I think there's a certain orthodoxy to it. I think that's always not a very attractive part of it, a sense that we're always right, they're always wrong. I'd like to see it continue to mature, and it will. It's going to become a fascinating world. I think I will say this. I was for many years a syndicated columnist, and I wrote for the San Francisco newspapers for 15 years, and I was a real newspaper person. I was edited. I had an editor, Gail Benziger, and other editors, Phil Bronstein, and they were tough editors, and they would get on my copy, and they'd straighten me out and say, how come you didn't check with this guy, or why don't you check with that guy? Who's that source? What's that senior official? I really think editing is important. And so I don't know how we're going to get to the next step with blogging. How are we going to get to editing? Now, that said, columnists, syndicated columnists, don't get edited. And so in a sense, I'm not bragging here that we're better. But I do think we need to have fact-checking and some level of intellectual, not ideological, fairness. And I really think that will help the blogging world. And I don't know how we get to that next level. Certainly Slate has editors, and some of these online sites have editing. I think we got to get to a higher level of a variety and a little bit of iconoclasm on the left, where a person says, I'm pro-left on every issue. I have a problem with a promiscuous attitude towards abortion, for example, or I'm not really able to defend illegal immigration per se, or just tell me an area where you're not quite in line with every other liberal or left opinion. I love that, because maybe that's because I who I am. And I guess I think that's where I'd like to see the bloggers get to.
Chris, let me ask you about the debate next week. You're going to be hosting a debate on economic issues with the Republican candidates, right?
Right, out in Tuesday Michigan. Night in Dearborn. Yeah, I think we're going to talk a lot about jobs and what's happening to our heavy industry. And my God, you know, when I was growing up, you could leave high school and get a job at a big factory and raise a family.
Are you going to do something different out there? Because a moment ago you said you don't like the format of these debates. Is there any way that you can make it a little more real and make it sound like a real conversation?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so, because I've got to figure out a way to say how it affects people's regular lives. Mm-hmm. Families with three or four generations at GM now find themselves with a company like Chrysler being sold to Cerberus, some equity company. So what's going to happen to the retirement program? What's going to happen to the pensions? What's going to happen to the health care for seniors? Then you see the UAW dealing away those responsibilities and removing the accountability of these big corporations for the health care of their retirees. I'm worried. I mean, a lot of liberals thought the enemy was the corporation. What happens when the corporation hands off accountability to some equity firm that has no heart at all?
And this is going to be the first glimpse we're going to get next week at Fred Thompson.
Fred's going to be in the spotlight. There is no doubt he will be number one target.
And what
target
do you think?
Zone.
I mean, what have you seen
I'm
so gonna, far?
I'm going to have to see. Mm. I mean, I'm not going to say something here he can use against me, but I do think we're going to watch Fred, because he's got to get out there and engage and answer some questions. You know, he's been criticized for not knowing certain things. Well, we'll see.
Mm. Well, Chris Matthews,
when he referred to the Soviet Union, by the way, I do sympathize with him, because I still say call countries like Burma by their old names. You know, I don't think that's the stupidest thing in the world.
No, I heard Condoleezza Rice do that just a couple of months ago. That's a mistake that some people can make. Chris Matthews, what a pleasure. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me on Talk.
Chris Matthews is host of Hardball on MSNBC. His new book is called Life's a Campaign: What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. We have an excerpt at npr.org/talk from his book. Coming up, what happens to diplomacy when America's embassies become anti-terrorist bunkers? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.